Well, good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Welcome back, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
You were sorely missed. And welcome to everybody from Sesshin and new people, new to the Quaker sitting floating Zendo venue. So we should do introductions around
Judy.
Hello.
My name is Sarah.
Yeah.
Leslie.
Ron.
Yeah.
Nasri.
Paul.
Jeffrey. Roman.
Wendy.
Ron.
Ari.
Violet.
So it was quite a session. Yeah. I just saw the very last day, but some of you were up at Chikoji from Thursday through Sunday, and it was a remarkable gathering in many different ways. In the end, we all ended up weeping. There was a tremendous amount of grief expressed because there was a couple there who had lost a child. And so we all had a chance to share in their experience. It was not expected, but it was certainly very helpful in trying to understand Buddha's teaching about suffering, about how we are so devastated by changes that to things that we love very, very much and can't bear to lose. Actually, everything we lose in the end. In the end, we end up losing ourselves. And practice is about bringing ourselves to the place where we're letting go. Sometimes it's called opening the hand of thought. That instead of holding tightly, we just open up and allow it to be the way it is. And allow it to be painful if it's painful. If it's difficult, it's difficult. We can't make it be something else. But we can see it. I was very fortunate that I had a chance after meeting with everyone in the Zendo in the afternoon. I went over to see Jhana, who is one of the residents at Chikoji, who is in the last stages of cancer, and who has had years and years of practice with pain. And her way of being with her situation was so inspiring that she had faced many, many difficulties and a lot of self-doubt and pain of every kind. And she had been working on her life and her understanding and her view of suffering for many, many years. And it showed in how she could be with what was happening to her. She could be with it. So we're studying this book, which is by the Dalai Lama. And it's the study of the Four Noble Truths, Buddha's teaching. The teaching about suffering. First, we have to notice it. Notice that how painful life can be and how attached we are to the outcome of good stuff, especially. Good stuff. We just hate to lose. We just hate it. It's so hard. And yet, of course, we're very loving and compassionate and kind people, and we become very attached for good reason. It's very necessary and important. But to be caught up in desire to expand on what we want and want more and more and more is where our suffering begins. And when we begin to see that, to see that wanting more of what we already have is a kind of sickness. So then Buddha's teaching, the second part of it was that having seen that, we have a chance to practice to understand it, to begin to see how it works, to see the places where we are holding on too tightly, and the places where we're picking and choosing all the time. I want this and I don't want that, and I like that and I don't like that, and I'm always feeling very uncomfortable because nothing is right. I can never relax. Everything has to be better. Without actually noticing where we are in the present moment and how fine it is right now, just as it is. Just like that. We're always busy in our minds trying to generate up new experiences and new excitement. And Buddha was pointing out that that's because we don't want to notice how uncomfortable we really are and how our view is so confused. So the recommendation is just to study, just to give yourself enough time and space to get to know yourself. Know your own mind. Examine your mind. Examine your life. How it's lived. Not how you want it to be, but how it actually is. Because from that place, from that most modest place, then you can generate whatever you need. And it's authentic. It's real. So Buddha's, the third point is that you can do this. And the fourth point is there's just a way to live a healthy, intelligent, wise, and compassionate life. Get a job that isn't killing animals or soaked in liquor or all the things that we do that are a big mistake as human beings. Especially generate the right way of looking at our own life and at other people's lives without judgment. Forgiving ourselves when we make a mistake, forgiving others. And having a wider and more generous view. And having correct way of speaking and not speaking too much. Often our speech is generated to sort of create a cloud around ourselves so that we're not noticed in the way that maybe we don't want to be noticed. To find ways of expressing the truth of things as we see it, and honoring that, respecting and honoring our own mind and others as well. And having a mindfulness practice and a meditation practice that keeps bringing us back over and over to be just like this. Nothing special, but just this. Which is really what we are, all we are. It's a wonderful place to be. So this book is giving us the Vajrayana view, which is the Tibetan version of Buddhism. And it's very much more complicated than Zen. So I've been skipping some parts of it. I hope you all will forgive me. And if you want to know more, it's all in here. It's alive and well. So the next thing that we have come to is karma. And the Vajrayana view of karma is very much more complicated than anything we ever talk about in Zen. It's a very complex way of thinking about how things come to be. And it's about the coming and going of things, how things change. And basically, Buddha's teaching was that our ignorance of how things are for ourselves creates a whole chain of reaction that creates this taking in of information about me and identifying me in a particular way that then I project out into the world as a kind of presentation and act, some kind of act of being. Of course, we all have to get up out of bed and be somebody every single day. But the karmic temptation is to try to be somebody we're not. And that's because our view is so skewed about the self, that the self has to be, we feel, this one thing. That's often what our parents told us or what our Sunday school teacher told us. You know, we are conditioned in many ways to experience ourself as this one. So a lot of Buddhist practice is just exploring what those conditioned situations are in our mind and testing them. Is this true? Am I like that? Is this a good thing to be? What's under it? What's real? And so you can get off of this chain reaction as a human being. You can step right off and stay in a more honest place, in a place where you're willing to be who you are and where you are and how you are, and explore that. Otherwise, it just keeps going round and around and around, and that's what karma is, basically. So one thing causes another thing, one idea causes another idea, and we get all caught up in thinking, 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 thinking. And all of our thinking is just a generation of nobody knows what. We still can't define what thought is, what consciousness is. It's a huge question now. People are actually beginning to believe that it is a question, not something made up. But nobody knows what it is. But we know as we sit, we know as we move about the world that we are constantly generating thoughts. And so if we're unconscious about our thinking, we get driven by it. The thinking just pushes us in all kinds of different directions. It's based on our emotion and our memories, and we end up being very confused. Or if we allow ourselves to come to a stop at least once a day and just be quiet and just come back to being what we are, we're not so driven by this turning, this trying to be somebody that we're not. So I think that's what I'm going to well, it's about action. Another definition of karma is action. And Dalai Lama says here, although there are many different types of negative action, the Buddhist scriptures summarize them as the 10 negative or 10 non-virtuous actions. There are 3 actions of body and 4 of speech and 3 of mind. The 3 bodily negative actions are killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. Does this sound familiar to anybody? The 4 negative actions of speech are lying, engaging in divisive speech, using harsh words, and engaging in senseless gossip. And the 3 negative mental actions are covetousness, harboring harmful thoughts and intentions, and holding wrong views. It's a description of what we call the precepts, which is what we live by. No killing, no stealing, no lying, no sexual misconduct, no abusing alcohol or drugs, no praising self and blaming others, no dwelling on past mistakes, no hoarding materials or teaching, no being angry, and no abusing the 3 treasures, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. In other words, your most precious self, your best self. This is what we receive over and over again. In Zen, we have a ceremony for the full moon when we recite the precepts. And at every ordination, from the very first ordination to the more and more, at every wedding, at every funeral, we take the precepts again. They're not God telling us how to be good. They're about reminding us how we want to be, how to connect with our best self, and let that be enough. It's very simple. It's this Eightfold Path, this teaching about ourself is so simple. It's not fancy. It isn't decorated with gold and silver. It's just how to be a really connected person. So that we find, as we practice meditation, we find how deeply connected we are to everything and everybody else. We have to see, as I said last week, that we're being held by everything. That the floor is holding us, the earth is holding us, the chair is holding you, the room is holding us. And we ourselves are holding each other. All of us are holding each other in our mind, heart. We don't say just mind, we say mind, heart in Zen. It's one thing with 2 ways of its expressing. It's a loving and wise way of being in the world. So Dalai Lama talks about stages, and we go through first stage and second stage about fundamental ignorance, and it's different from our practice. Our practice is just to sit and have no gaining idea at all. We're not trying to be better. The more we try to be better, the more complicated it gets, and the sillier it gets in a way. It gets very messy. The more we try not to do something, the more we end up doing it in some way. In meditation, trying not to think is a great example of that. The more you try not to think, the more you think, and the more it makes you crazy. It's just the way we are. And we like to feel like we can control things, but actually we're much better off if we release ourselves into the whole dynamic of life itself. Let ourselves go as it. We are the life of the world, each one of us. Well, I think that's enough of this. This chapter. We can talk more about it next week. The next week is a discussion of nirvana, which again is something that we don't really talk about in Zen. So I'm not sure how much I'm going to talk about it, and I'll say as much as I think is necessary, and then we'll go on to the fourth one of the Eightfold Path. And I gave a talk on the Eightfold Path on Sunday, so that will be on the Jikoji website if you all are curious in the meantime.
Good.
And some of you have already heard it, so so there's time for questions.
I guess I'll just jump right in.
Good.
So this cycle of cause and effect, it's kind of karma, right?
Yes.
Because I guess my understanding from what I'm kind of digging through is that I think you said it, just step off that carousel is really the the peaceful place to be. I think that's what I got from what you're saying.
Yeah.
And in regards to meditation, shikantaza, that's for the short amount of time that my body can be still, that's what I'm really trying to do.
Yes.
I usually, when I sit down, I think about the first chapter of the Diamond Sutra, where he goes around, he gets some rice.
Yes.
He comes back, he adjusts his body, and he turns his attention to what's in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the wall, you know, for me.
Yes.
In my practice. And that's where I begin to see myself. You know, because that's the path I'm the path I'm on, and it's very different. You know, me, who I am, who I'm not pretending to be, who I really am, my true nature, is a little. You know, I've tried to hide it my whole life, and as it comes out. You know, some people that have known me a long time are a little uneasy about it.
It happens.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the one person who's not is me, and it's really cool. So, yeah.
Thank you, Roman. That's wonderful.
If you're not staying home as we go about life, you keep on generating karma. But if we are at that place as we go about living our life, don't we also generate karma?
We are, yes. Okay. And we do have something to do with that. That's the action that's so important for us. We can't really do anything about where we came from in the first place. Because there isn't a plain, simple karma, like one big bang, and then we're there. It's that we're put together with all these tiny little vectors, you know, going back all the way to the beginning of the Big Bang, really, that have created this situation right here, right now, as us. That's immeasurable. It's huge. It's so many different things that went into every single moment between then and now that we can't measure that or change it very much. But once we're here right now and wide awake, we have everything to say about how things go from here, every moment. And a part of our practice is to become aware of how much we can change things for the better, how sometimes we don't want to, or that we have negative things happening inside us that we can either exercise or not. And so we have some power over the karma that's coming up, that is a continuation of the action of our life. We are really an enactment of life itself, acting itself through us. So it's very important. The precepts are especially important because they're guidance for us in how to do that. And sometimes it takes many years to accept and agree to all 10 of them. And sometimes we don't, you know, and we say, why me, God? Why is this happening? Or something like that. But that we can't really control. I think when things happen to us, We bow to it and try to understand it deeply without objecting. But it's hard. It's hard to do. Hard to accept. Yeah. Paul?
Isn't it amazing that we can do it? With simple meditation can actually make that happen.
Yes. Yes. We don't understand that either. It changes us and it creates conditions that are better for everybody. and we don't know how that works exactly, but we do know it works, and we do know how important it is. Yes. Leslie?
So the Vajrayana approach, I guess that's the way I'd say it, is in the Mahayana tradition.
Yes.
As is Zen.
Yes.
So some of what's being written there, it isn't that as Zen practitioners we disagree or we feel that there's fundamental errors.
No, not at all.
It's simply that the Zen approach is, I think, is a more embodied,
yes,
practice,
yes,
and less intellectual.
The Vajrayana practice is very intellectual, sometimes entirely. There are many, many practices and understandings that are very complicated and explaining everything in ways that at the very end of practice, if you're a student who've hung in there for years and years, then they say, you should just sit. And don't have any gaining ideas.
And that's where we start.
And we start that way. And they're horrified that we do that. They think, you know, we should study hard all these complicated things and then sit. But the Zen understanding is that sitting creates the questions and that everything comes up as we practice. And so we do study, of course, but it's from a different point of view. A different angle. Yeah. Thank you. That's a real good question. So, yes, I'm not challenging them at all. It's a wonderful practice.
I just wanted to be sure I was understanding.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
I want to use my professional life to relieve some of the world's suffering, but at the same time, like professional life, school can be very stressful and you can get caught up. So how do you use your professional life to deepen your Zen practice? What's the right attitude to have?
If you have a meditation practice, you will find, like Roman, that if you sit every day, it will make a difference. It will. I always think we get boiled down with meditation. We don't get transformed so much as just cooked down like a sauce. So we're watery when we start, and then we become tastier and tastier and more ourselves as we practice. So it's highly recommended. Don't try to study so much. In the beginning, it's not useful. The best way is just to sit a lot if you can.
And it's okay to do this at home without the taking expert.
You can sit on your lunch hour. You know, a lot of people do that. They go and sit in their car. You can sit at 6 before you go to get even just sit in your night clothes for as long as you can and then have breakfast. Just make it a part of an integral part of your day. And you will find you're friendlier with your mind and you're more connected in the world. Right?
So the difference, or the same as Zen, is supposed to be the school of sudden enlightenment on some level.
Well,
but there is a lot of effort that may and may not go into that, but it's kind of contradictory, or there's a little bit of a dilemma, because the more you try too hard, you're not going to get it, but you already have it.
Suzuki Roshi.
So the approach is not like Vajrayana exactly, maybe in Japan, in some schools it's more like.
Well, Suzuki Roshi spoke about that. He was asked if he was enlightened and if it came fast or slow. And he said, oh, what did he say?
It was instantaneous.
It was instantaneous, but it took a long time. That's, thank you, Paul. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, very fast, but it took a long, long time. So we don't talk much about enlightenment in our Soto practice of Zen, because it becomes a very big goal and it will make you very crazy. So better just simply to be, to connect yourself as much as you can into the vitality of your own life and the life around you. That's a lot already.
We don't have so many steps and levels mapped out like Tibetan Buddhism.
Right, right. Yes.
The practice,
but as you...
when it's supposed to, it's already happened, but you'll realize it when...
Exactly, as you say. In fact, Dogen said that we're enlightened as we sit. Our sitting mind is enlightenment mind. So it's why we do this. That's what enlightenment means. It doesn't mean some big blast of brilliant something or other. It means simply what I've been describing. Just utterly engaged in everything. Roman?
A quote I heard said, a wave in the ocean is enlightened the moment it realizes that it's water.
Yes. That's very nice. When it's part of the ocean. Yeah. That's us. That's us. Well, it's time to stop.
So we're having a half day sit, not next Saturday, but the 19th.
Nine to 12.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah. It's good. It's a good space for it. Anything else?
No. So are all the talks for the session going to be on Chikoji's website?
I don't think so. I think only the Sunday one.
Oh, special.
We are going to be having a sesshin. We should mention that too on the
22nd.
Violet told me last just 2 days ago.
22nd
to the 29th. Yeah. So come one and all.
George.
Of September. Thank you, Judy. Mm-hmm. Yes. 1 minute sit.